Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Kurt Nikish, in for Sarah Green Carmichael. Innovation is hard. Even when it's clear, you have to do it to survive. Kodak is the popular poster child. The company tried and ultimately failed to manage the disruption of film cameras. But Kodak's far from alone. The list of established companies that have fallen short in their innovations, that list is long because it's just not that easy. But the rewards are high if you get it right. Disruptive change is the moment when market followers become market leaders, the moment when business legacies are created, and the moment when upstart leaders become some of the world's most admired executives. Our guest today has worked with scores of companies and leaders trying to do exactly this, transform their existing business and find new areas of growth. And he has some insights into the companies that make it, and the leadership qualities that made those transformations possible. Joining me now is Scott Anthony. He's a managing partner at Innosight, a management consulting firm, and he's a co-author of the new book, Dual Transformation: How to Reposition Today's Business While Creating the Future. Scott, thanks so much for talking with the HBR IdeaCast.
Kurt, I'm thrilled to be here.
Why is it so hard to beat disruption?
When people hear the word disruption, your mouth contorts when you say it. It's a word that sounds scary and it feels threatening. The thing that people miss is that disruption creates growth. While, of course, as it's changing business models in a space, there are winners and losers. But the net result, anytime we've studied a disruptive change, is that a market grows. So this is not necessarily a threat to people. This is a tremendous opportunity for people who think and act in the right way. But the fundamental challenge we observed is when people see disruption coming at them, they say, we've got to do something about it. And that's not right. They don't have to do a thing about it. They have to do two things about it. And this is the title of our book, Dual Transformation. The dual is A, repositioning today's business to make it more resilient against the disruptors coming at you in your current market, and B, taking advantage of the energy inherent in that disruption to go and play offense and go and create some new growth businesses. You try to mush those things together, you do neither of them well. So instead of looking at change as a monolith where you're doing one thing, you got to do both of those. And they have to be distinct, linked in the right sort of way. But if you don't separate it and manage those differently, you get yourself in a whole heap of trouble.
So let's talk about the linking in the right sort of way, because I think students of disruption know about skunkworks projects, and they've studied ideas coming out of companies, having a hard time kind of getting off on their own or needing to be separate. But you're talking about even one further thing, and that's maybe new to a lot of people, which is linking it to sort of the existing business.
Yes, and this is the thing that is most subtle in the book and the thing that's hardest to get right. And the thing that's also hardest to say, well, just remember these three bullet points, which I will do in a minute, but remember these three bullet points and you'll be set. So if you go back to Christensen's original work on disruption, he said the answer is simple. You create a spin-out venture, and that's the way you fight against the disruption. So we say there's certainly some truth to that. You certainly need some degree of organizational separation. But if you're going to go as far as creating something that is a truly disconnected entity, just go and invest in or buy a startup company, as it'll be faster than anything you're going to do anyway. And that might be the right answer. But what we're talking about—
And it may be easier to separate the culture and to do all those sorts of things that come
absolutely
up, right?
But also recognize the limitation of what you're doing. Because if you're doing that, you are depriving the new venture, you're depriving the startup of what might be unique enabling capabilities that only you have. So in the book, one of the examples we give of this is something that we wrote about in a 2012 Harvard Business Review article, The New Corporate Garage, an effort by Medtronic to create a new business model in India to change the way that pacemakers were marketed, distributed, and ultimately paid for.
Medtronic is sort of a medical device maker.
Correct.
Right?
World's largest medical device maker. India should have been a great market for it. More heart disease, sadly, in India than any country in the world. Yet sales of pacemakers were minuscule. You spend 5 minutes in India, you get it. People pay for healthcare out of their own pocket. It's too expensive. Primary care doesn't work well, so people didn't know about it. Medtronic figured out an answer to this, inventing not a new technology, but a new business model called Healthy Heart for All. And it had three components. It had direct-to-consumer marketing. It had rural diagnostic camps to be able to diagnose more people more rapidly. And the world's first loan program for a medical device that gets implanted in your chest. Medtronic did something that maybe two other companies in the world could do. It took advantage of unique assets that only Medtronic and a couple others had. Understanding of the Indian healthcare market, the IP protection it had around its pacemaker, the regulatory clearance to operate in that market, access to the hospitals, a balance sheet that could allow it to do the loan program. Had it created a completely separate spin-out venture as a separate business, it never would have been able to do any of those things. In circumstances like that, where you're saying we've got something that rather than being a dilemma, is an opportunity where we can fight unfairly because we've got things other people don't, we've got to think about not complete separation, but very careful linking. And the reason why it's careful is because you do need to push in different directions. You do need to act differently. You do need to have a different rhythm. You do need to have a different approach. So that distinction is important, but the tie between the core and the new is important as well.
If that capabilities link is so important, it seems like established companies should be crushing it when it comes to disruption, right? Because they have these capabilities that startups don't have.
But, you know, I think this is why it is subtle but important, how you actually go and do it. One of the mantras that we have in the book is A does A and B does B. And then the three bullets that I promised before, the first bullet is you are very careful in selecting what are the unique capabilities you have. It's not just that you're a big company or you've got brands or whatever. You have actually identified things that are unique enabling capabilities. And these are sometimes subtle and hard to see. The second thing is you have come up with a formal way to manage that capabilities link. And one of the examples that we go into in the book is work that co-author and my colleague Clark Gilbert did when he was transforming Deseret Media, a media organization in the state of Utah. He formed what he called exchange teams, special purpose teams that had members of both sides of his organization that would come together to address issues. Then the third key is that the CEO or some other senior leader has to be actively involved in it, even if it feels like it's too operational and too low level for them. They've got to be arbitrating between A and B. So if you don't have someone who will go in and say, nope, this time we're not going to do that. We're going to do this instead. You will have what we sometimes call the sucking sound of the core, take a well-intentioned disruptive idea and lead to it looking like everything else you've ever done before. It's really hard stuff.
What's one of your favorite examples of a sucking sound leading to a failure?
Yeah, I just think it's such a brilliant example. There was a Wall Street Journal article about this about a decade ago. It was about Microsoft, where Microsoft essentially had all the components in place to create Google. So first, a little bit of explanation. Google isn't a search company. Google is an advertising company. Search is the vehicle to help it sell advertising, but that's really what it does. Ties advertising to search terms. I guess I should call it Alphabet now. Google is what makes all the money for Alphabet through search-based advertising.
Sure.
Well, Microsoft is smart. Microsoft sees search-based advertising is beginning to come. Microsoft gets a lot of the pieces to do it. It's got the technology. It makes some acquisitions. It gets a team in place. And then it asked the core business to run an experiment around it. And Microsoft, of course, had MSN, a content engine. And the core business essentially poisons the experiment because they're worried it will cannibalize some of the display ads that they have. And they do all sorts of little subtle things that you probably didn't even notice at the time that led to the experiment not working. And then they could credibly say, hey, there's no business here. And they killed the effort. So it was all there. They could have created the hundreds of billions of dollars of value that Google went on to create. But the core business in lots of subtle ways made it impossible.
So much of the conflict between performance engines and innovation engines and companies is about money. You know, you just often have that situation where some people are thinking, we make the money, but why are they getting all the new hires?
Which is, again, why the CEO's got to get involved in it, right? Because the CEO or equivalent leaders in the leadership team can say, you might not like this, but this is the portfolio of investments that we're going to make as a company. And you, as our core A business, you have a budget that you have freedom to spend, and we'll give you operational autonomy to do that for you to create a great future for yourself. But what I, as a leader, do with the returns that you're creating, that's a different question. And this is, again, why that A does A, B does B is so critical. Because if you don't do that, well, A will say, well, I'm funding B, so I want to have some say into what it's doing. But they're good at doing A, not at doing B. And if you, on the other hand, B will say, in many cases, that they're the new people. They're the people who are doing the sexy, innovative stuff. They'll say, oh, well, I can do the core stuff too, and I want to go help with that. But they actually don't necessarily know anything about doing what is your historical legacy business. So that separation and saying, I as a leader will say, whatever it is, 90% of my money is being spent here, but 10 is being spent here. And that is a protected amount. And I'm going to be willing to tolerate different forms of financial returns over different periods of time, blah, 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 blah. What it really comes down to is the resource allocation mechanisms inside an organization, how money is spent, how time is spent, what people are doing, et cetera, privileging the current business and underprivileging or underinvesting in the new stuff. So if you as a leader want to fight back, the answer is look at those resource allocation systems in your company. And they're systems. It's not just one thing. So this is hard stuff. I call it the collection of these four systems, the budget, the assets, the rewards, and time. I call it the shadow strategy, because they are the things that in many cases determine the strategy you're actually following. It's not what you say. It's not the proclamations you make. It's the way those resource allocation engines are allocating the resources in your organization.
I wonder how much shareholders and board members hold companies back from achieving dual transformations, because I mean, one of the companies that you mentioned in the book so admiringly is Netflix. As it was disrupting home movie rental places like Blockbuster, it was already working on how to disrupt itself and move to data streaming and get away from sending DVDs by mail. But that, of course, was a company that was funded by venture capitalists who are seasoned disruptors, right? Maybe not so at publicly traded companies where people invest because they're expecting sort of consistent returns. And so is that one of the reasons why corporations have a hard time achieving this, because they're held back by resource or expectations constraints?
I think it's a great question. And honestly, Kurt, I think a lot of this is self-inflicted. I remember I was doing a talk to a board of directors of a large publicly traded company in Singapore, saying to them, you've got no B. You have no transformation B. You need one. And one of the board members said, well, but you know, our shareholders, they expect dividends. And I said, but if you don't do this, there will not be dividends to give to the shareholders, because I can tell you the direction in which your core business is going, and that is down. So if you don't go and take advantage of the fact that it's still healthy now, 5 years from now, those dividends are going to zero. This is not an option. This is a necessity, either now or later. But if you wait until later, the window will be closed. If you go out with a credible story that says, this is our plan to transform, these are the milestones along the way, then number one, shareholders will give you more space than you realize. Number two, you will shape your shareholder base so that you've got ones who are going along the journey with you. Bertolini from Aetna says this. He was going out talking to shareholders about his plan. He was getting this question, that question, et cetera. And his response was, either you think I'm stupid or I'm lying to you. And neither one of those sentiments, if you have them, should lead to you investing in my stock. And if you don't, there's plenty of others who. So I think some of this gets to the leadership behaviors that's required. You need some courage when you do this. You need to be willing to stand tall and say, this is what we're going to do. Because in the long run, it's, and sometimes even the medium run, it's the right thing to do for the organization.
What are the characteristics of leaders that you've seen at companies that have been successful at this?
So the book, we keep it simple. I have four words, all that begin with C. So I try to make it as memorable as possible or as easy for people to remember as possible.
I think there already is a four C's thing,
yeah,
right?
I know. Everything, nothing new under the sun. But so the four C words that we used were courage, clarity, curiosity, and conviction. And so just a sentence about each. The courage is making the decision to begin to drive dual transformation before you're on the proverbial burning platform. Because by the time the platform's on fire, in most cases, it's too late. Then it's a Hail Mary pass, and those don't work too well.
Courage is a rare quality.
You will, in many cases, get professional managers at large organizations that will have some risk aversion. As they, you know, the old line from the Nobel-winning writer Bob Dylan, "You ain't got nothing. You ain't got nothing to lose." You know, the more you have, the more you have the possibility of loss.
Right.
So there's some natural human reasons why courage is in short supply inside leadership teams.
We began the show, you know, mentioning Kodak, and now they're an example of a company that tried to.
Very courageous in many ways.
Right, you know, very courageous, right?
It's one of the things that I find painful, and also I think people miss many of the lessons from Kodak. You know, people will say, well, Kodak was blind. Not at all. Digital camera invented by Kodak, commercialized by Kodak, had a bunch of different ways to get. Well, they say, okay, it wasn't that. It's that they didn't do online stuff. False. Kodak in 2001 bought Ophoto, a photo sharing site that existed before Facebook. So it wasn't that they were myopic. It wasn't that they missed some of the big shifts. The business model really held them back. They did have a fixation around the silver halide film, it appears, that made it hard for them to say, hey, we're going to have something that isn't actually based on people printing things at all. But it wasn't that they were too timid. It wasn't that they weren't willing to make investments. It was the ability to walk away from the legacy business model that I think ultimately got them.
So they were courageous, but not courageous enough.
Yeah. And I think if you were to Monday morning quarterback, you would say it was the courage to walk away from the business model. And I think this is an important part about disruption. You know, Christensen will say this. One of the mistakes he made is in his first writing, he called it disruptive technology. But the technology is the easy part. It's the business model that is the hard part. When people in many organizations tell us they are digitally transforming, what they're doing is digitizing their operations. That's good, but that's table stakes. What you really need to do is think about what are the new digital business models that you're going to build, platforms, finding ways to take all the data that you are producing and find new services you can offer on top of it, taking your own digital capabilities and turning them into for-profit businesses like Amazon has done with Amazon Web Services. That's what you really need to do to both drive growth and fight against the people coming after you. But people don't think about the business model stuff enough.
Who's a courageous leader that you like to exemplify?
Mark Bertolini is a good example of this, where...
At Aetna.
At Aetna, correct. So,
right,
you know,
so this is a medical insurer. We talked about them briefly.
Correct. $65 billion company, health insurance, primarily, in fact, if not entirely, in the United States. The thing that I find so interesting about Bertolini is he becomes CEO 6 or 7 years ago. Everything's great. Stock price is going up. Revenues are going up. Earnings go up 38% in his first year. So it'd be easy just to keep playing the hand that you're dealt and keep driving that.
And
he
golf.
Says, no. Yeah, yeah. You just go play golf. That's right. And he says, no. He says, I believe, and my leadership team believes, the health insurance market in the United States is going to die at some point. And that's true for everything. Every business is mortal. Every brand is mortal. Every business model is mortal. And Bertolini's point is, I want to get ahead of it, not be forced to do something because we haven't thought through it. So decided then, before they needed to, while everything looked good, to launch a pretty aggressive dual transformation strategy. Has everything worked? Of course not. But Aetna is in a much stronger position now because it had the courage to begin to do it before it needed to. And I think we need more leaders like that. And, you know, Bertolini, we talked about him before, saying, you know, telling investors essentially, if you don't like what I'm doing, then go and invest in a different stock. I mean, that's not an easy thing to say to investors, but I think that's part of what you need to do.
Clarity. That's the next quality that you itemized is something that's key for leaders to be able to drive a dual transformation. And what are you talking about here?
So there's two parts to clarity. So the one part of the strategic choice is, what is the equivalent of John F. Kennedy's moonshots? What are the things that you say, these are the big opportunity areas that we're going to go after? Singtel, mobile advertising, cybersecurity, big data analytics. For what Mark Bertolini and his team at Aetna are doing, it's getting into essentially healthcare IT. The book goes into excruciating detail, according to one of the people who reviewed it about Manila Water, a water utility company in the Philippines that was struggling with the curse of success. The problem that Manila Water had is, how do we keep growing? We need to go and do different things. So we provide in the book a front row seat as Manila Water decides to focus on packaged water and a couple other opportunities. That's one part of it, going and saying, these are the things we'll do. As you can probably guess from the inflection in my voice, the other part of it is, these are the things we won't do, or these are the things that we will stop doing. One of the things that we see companies run into the trap of all the time is the hundreds or thousands of flowers problem, where they say, well, we're just going to place lots of bets, lots and lots of bets, lots
shots
and lots and
goal,
lots of bets,
right?
lots and lots and lots of bets, lots and lots of shots on goal. And then you say, are any of them hitting? Are any of them going anywhere? And you have all these fledglings, all of which are undernourished. It never works. Every company is trying to do too many things. Every company needs to go and purge its portfolio to make sure it's focused on the right things. And sometimes that's letting go of what used to be the core of the business. You know, Scott Cook and Intuit, another courageous thing, Intuit made its business on the backs of Quicken, personal financial software package. It sold Quicken off last year. It said, we're no longer in the business of providing this package. Even though it is the history and the legacy of the company, they said, this is not the future. This is the past, and somebody else should run that. That's a really bold and very clear strategic choice for it to make.
Discipline seems to be a theme here, both courage and clarity so far. Curiosity is...
The opposite of discipline, right?
Yeah.
Paradox, I said this is tough stuff, right?
Yeah.
So curiosity is recognizing that once you've made a choice, once you said that this is Singtel, it's going to be mobile advertising, the exact right strategy, it will never be clear from the beginning. Even when Kennedy made his moonshot speech in the early 1960s, they didn't know the technologies that were going to get them there. They very consciously said, there are a couple or three different rocket technologies we're going to simultaneously explore, because who knows? So they then had this paradox where you say, very clear strategic choice, but then we're going to diffuse it a little bit and go and explore multiple paths to get there. So you need the clarity to focus, but then the curiosity to recognize that the right path will take some fumbling and trying and exploring different areas. And this is where you start to actually go and say, we do need some different shots on goal. So I realize I am totally contradicting myself, but that's the challenge here. Strategic choices at the macro level, curiosity and exploration at the micro level, with then, as you begin to figure out, is this not this, stop that, get more resources to this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just like a venture capitalist will do with his or her portfolio.
Got it. But at least a defined goal.
Correct.
Right.
The way co-author Mark Johnson, I will give him full credit for this phrase, what we call a future back strategy, where you say that's how you paint the picture of what tomorrow is going to look like. And the picture will be an impressionist painting. As you're not going to know precisely what it will look like, but you know it's more this than that. And one of our rules for strategy is, you are rough on the answer because you can't be anything but you are precise on the assumptions that you're making. Because as you're precise on assumptions, you create testable hypotheses that you can go and experiment around. And then the experiments that you run ultimately tell you it's this versus that. And in all of this, you mentioned the word discipline. Not to give you the seventh paradox of the podcast, but here it is. There is a very clear discipline to the experimentation that very consciously is undisciplined in spaces. There needs to be fun. There needs to be play. There needs to be creativity. There needs to be times where you remove the guardrails. And what good leaders do is recognize when it's this versus that. And of course, it's a lot easier to say that than it is to actually go and do it.
Your fourth C is conviction.
Every transformation journey that we have been a part of or studied is a journey. It's not a 1 month and you're done, 1 quarter and you're done, 1 year and you're done. It's at least a 3-year journey, and in many cases, longer than that. And along the journey, you never know exactly when they will strike, but there will be crises, predictable crises. There will be crises of commitment, where the people who are running your A effort will say, are we going to get sold? Are we going to get shut? Is there still a future here? People running the B business will say, I've seen the statistics about incumbents driving disruption. I don't think we're really in it for the long haul. You're playing now, but you won't. So you've got that type of crisis. You then have crises that are conflict, where A and B say, we want that IT resource, or we want that person, or we want access to that customer. And who do you back? You can't back both. So you got to make a call as a leader. And then you get what is perhaps the most subtle, but maybe the most important crisis, that of identity. Who are you? Who are you becoming? What do you do when the answer to those two things is materially different? So you know that there will be crises along the way. The conviction to persevere allows you as a leader to say, all right, this is a part of a journey. We will take the crisis. We will deal with it, but we won't crumble in the face of something going wrong. And the argument that we make in the book, beyond having a good future back strategy that sets a good view for where you're trying to get to, having purpose or a meaning to what you're doing, beyond increasing return on invested capital from 13.2 to 13.4% or whatever, is in our eyes a really critical component of having that conviction.
Some people would say, you know, if it's really hard for these big established companies to do this, maybe they should fail. Maybe they should be disrupted and let other companies grow in their place. What's wrong with that?
So I think that the basic thing that's wrong with it is if you talk about that process of the established company failing and the new company emerging, the challenge is that creative destruction carries a very heavy transaction tax. You think about all the great people, all the great assets, all the great capabilities that were built in a place like Kodak, the intrinsic tie that they had to the communities in which they operated in Rochester, New York, and other places, and you go and visit those places now, you see that there is a real downside to creative destruction. I don't think we should prop up poorly run companies. That's not the argument at all. Instead, it's helping companies become the next version of themselves so they can realize that the potential that they have. My own personal view is the greatest untapped source of energy in the world isn't in the sun, it isn't in the wind, it isn't in the waves. It is inside organizations that are capable of doing so much more if they can learn to think and act in the right way.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for talking with the HBR IdeaCast.
Kurt, it has truly been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's Scott Anthony. He is a managing partner at InnoSight and the co-author of the book Dual Transformation. You can find it at hbr.org. The HBR IdeaCast is now on Spotify. So if you use that app to listen to music and podcasts, ours is now there too. However you do it, thanks for listening to the HBR IdeaCast. I'm Kurt Nikisch.